Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the second part of the French Connections Monday edition. It's the 20th day of March, 2006. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith, of course, and this is the French Connection you're listening to, coming to you from central France, from upstate New York, and from California today. It is great to have my guest with me today. His name is Dan McGowan. He is a professor and a researcher and a lecturer, and has been looking into the facts around the things we discuss on the French Connection for some time. There are many, many hardworking investigators around the world who forwarded many, many facts to for the rest of us to absorb. And Dan does a great job with some events that took place back in the 1946-47 area that we decided to talk about today. And Dan, first, I'd like maybe Dan to first welcome you and give you an opportunity to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm a professor of economics at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. I've been here since 1973, and along in the mid-1980s, I began to take an interest in Israel and Palestine, particularly in connection with the Israeli-South African connection. That was the period of time when when our country was very much against apartheid and for regime change in South Africa, and it occurred to me that we were being very hypocritical by trying to deny arms going to South Africa except if they went from Israel, by trying to boycott South African exports, particularly their Krugerrands but interestingly, never their diamonds, because the diamonds went mostly to Israel, where they were cut and processed.
Well, what occurred to you when you saw these facts? I mean, that there was some very, very high placed collusion going on between the two governments, Israel and the United States.
Well, there was, and a lot of the armaments and so forth were identical, whether it was the Galil assault rifle or the South African R4 or whatever. There was a lot of connection between the two countries, but it was the American hypocrisy of looking at one country and asking for regime change and not asking anything of the other country that really caught my attention.
Well, you made some parallels to the apartheid system in South Africa and what had been going on in Palestine under the Israeli control of that West Bank and Gaza and parts of Jerusalem that had supposedly were supposed to remain an international city. And you explained to those facts to me in a private call. You want to maybe go into that a little bit?
Well, it was this connection between Israel and South Africa that caught my attention. And then in the latter part of the 1980s, I went to Israel because as a child I had always heard that that the Germans knew what went on in the persecution of the Jews in World War II, but they never did anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans knew about concentration camps, but they ignored it. And so I decided to go to Israel and look at an Israeli concentration camp in the Negev Desert at Ketziot and to see what was going on so that I couldn't be blamed for standing by and acting complicit as an American, or why there weren't more Israeli Jews that didn't protest about this type of treatment. So I went to Israel after the beginning of the first Intifada. In fact, I think it was the summer of 1989.
Mm-hmm.
And I engaged a lawyer in Jerusalem, an Israeli Jewish lawyer, who defended Palestinians. And I engaged her and offered her $2,000 to take me to this concentration camp in the Negev Desert. And she said that it was absolutely impossible to go there, that I couldn't get anywhere near it, I couldn't photograph it or anything else, but that at that time there were between 6,000 and 8,000 Palestinians in this concentration camp.
Hmm.
And I say concentration camp because that's precisely what Ketziot was. and is today. It is a place where political prisoners and only Palestinians, in the case of Ketziat, it's the place where they are put or concentrated, often without charge, often with 6 months detention and another 6 months and another 6 months, where their families can't go to see them, where they live in harsh conditions. I'm not talking about an extermination camp. I'm talking about a camp like Dachau in the 1930s.
Yep, yep.
And so one thing led to another, and I began to get very interested in the Israeli-Palestinian situation. I went to the most famous Holocaust museum at Yad Vashem. You know, there are hundreds of Holocaust museums all across the world.
Yes.
But the premier one is in Jerusalem, is at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. And at the same time, I went into the West Bank in Gaza. At that time, in 1989, I visited 10 hospitals, Palestinian hospitals, from East Jerusalem and Hebron and in Gaza and Rafah and so forth. And I witnessed the children in the hospitals with broken hands and broken arms. And in story after story, I found out how their hands and arms were broken. If they made the victory sign, a V for victory, which they all did, even after a home was demolished, the kids would all climb up on the rubble and make this sign. But if the Israeli soldiers caught them, they put their hand flat down on a board or on a stone, and they smashed it across the top with a baton. And they did that repeatedly, and in hundreds of instances, they broke those children's hands for showing that sign. If the child was caught throwing a rock, they held the arm away from the child with the top part of the arm down and hit him across the elbow, right on the edge of the elbow, which would shatter the bones and render the arm useless. And so many, many Palestinian people today have these broken arms and broken bones. And it was a deliberate policy of the Israeli government. In fact, it was Yitzhak Rabin who said, "We will deal with the Palestinians with might, power, and beating." And
now, this whole policy is reminiscent of how many of the Africans were treated in South Africa during the most oppressive years down there as well, wasn't it?
Interestingly enough, I had a South African for a roommate, a former member of the ANC, and he said that it was nowhere near as bad in South Africa as it was in Israel.
Ah, okay.
Nowhere nearly as bad. The police were very brutal, of course, and many people died, many blacks died in detention or at the hands of white policemen. But it was nowhere as systematic and as brutal as it was in Israel.
Well, I also understand that there were many, many hundreds of children shot dead for throwing stones as well. That once a kid was throwing a stone, he was open season for a sniper.
Well, there are some that were shot. Some were shot with plastic bullets from the .223, the standard round used in the M16. Some of those bullets were plastic, but at close range, they were as devastating as a regular bullet.
Yeah.
Some of the bullets were actually made into dum-dums. In other words, they were cut on the end of the bullet so that the bullet would shatter. And, of course, the renowned rubber bullet was never a rubber bullet. It was a plastic-coated .58-caliber steel bullet.
Yeah.
And at close range, and I have photographs of x-rays of this from the hospitals in 1989, those rubber bullets could penetrate a skull, and they often did at close range.
Well, now, you when you made these discoveries, had you anticipated finding these facts when you first left, or were you absolutely floored by the things you discovered?
Well, I didn't expect to see that. Of course, in the United States, we only hear one side of the story.
That's right.
We always hear of Jews as victims and of course, of Nazi atrocities and so forth. But Jews as perpetrators of atrocities, that's a story that doesn't get printed in the United States.
Why do you think that is, Dan?
It's a very elaborate type of control of the media. And
how about ownership?
And it has to do with ownership, it has to do with control, and it has to do with people in general, and not just Jews, but Christians as well, following along with this quest to build a Jewish state in historical Palestine. And you have people, of course, that are Jewish that are doing this, and are the most ardent Zionists, but you also have ardent Zionists like Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, Franklin Graham, Ralph Reed, Dick Armey, and a host of other people who are very important in the media, very important religious leaders, who are rabid Zionists. And by Zionists, I mean political Zionists.
Yep.
People who are working to build a Jewish state in Israel or Greater Israel or the land between the Mediterranean.
Why all this effort for that piece of burnt-out real estate?
Well, first of all, it's not burnt out.
Well, not anymore. I mean, they've actually used the resources of the region to bring it to life. It was a desert when they arrived there, but it was a burnt out place. Why all these? Why all the expression of? I mean, why would they invest hundreds of millions, even hundreds of billions of dollars over the last half century to bring a desert to life and kick out its native inhabitants? What's the purpose?
Okay, well, first, Darrell, I've got to correct you on this. And that is, it wasn't a desert. It wasn't a desert when the Israelis came there, and it's not a desert now. There were orchards all over historical Palestine. Of course, there was desert. There's desert today. But it was anything but uninhabited, and it was anything but a desert. Those are two myths that are often perpetrated by Zionists and have been told for the last 100 years as a justification for Eastern European Jews going there.
Wonderful to clear that up. Then what was their goal then? They could have bought themselves a country 50 times larger with the money they've expended trying to take that area over. What is their goal ultimately, in your view?
Well, indeed, they did think of alternative sites. The early Zionists did think of alternative sites, including Uganda and including Madagascar and including some other places. But there was this attraction to Palestine, and for many years, Jews have said to each other, next year in Jerusalem. This was a slogan that went back for a love of the land, the love of historical Israel, a spiritual form of Zionism, which is distinct from political Zionism or the idea of creating a state in this land.
Well, something has always...
Let me get to the...
Go ahead,
Dan. Your question directly.
Yep.
The reason is that that many Zionists consider Jews to be a separate people, not just a religion, and consider it impossible for Jews to really assimilate in the rest of the population, and so they seek to have a state of their own.
Well, haven't they actually done everything to foster that belief?
Yes, they have. Absolutely. But it's those two premises, namely that Jews are a separate people, and that Jews are not able to be assimilated into general society. Those two premises are key to Zionism.
Well, it's interesting because they've self-fulfilled that prophecy. In other words, they've set themselves up as apart from everyone else by design, and so I don't think there's anything genetic about it. On this program, we've done much research on Arthur Koestler's work and found out that many of the people claiming to have roots in the Holy Land, in fact, were converted to Judaism back in the 8th and 9th and 10th centuries in the region between Russia and the Constantinople regimes that were prevalent at that time. So many of these people don't even have Semitic roots.
It depends, of course, on your definition of Semitic. If by that you mean that they came from the lands between the Mediterranean and the Jordan, the answer is no, they didn't. They came from Khazaria or from the eastern part of Turkey. They were never olive-skinned people that lived in that land 2,000 years ago.
But they want you to believe that that's a fact today, don't they?
Sure. Sure, they do.
Yeah.
I mean, the people that believe it are the people that that are descendants of the Ashkenazi Jews.
Made a great deal of effort to minimize the Sephardic side of Judaism and marginalize them both. With the irradiation of their children, all the way down to marginalization politically. And they have the dominant role, this Khazarian-rooted, Frankist-rooted group. Now, what is their goal, independent of the Sephardi that has different genetic heritage? I mean, it seems as though to me, Dan, that they've got more of a virulent form of expression than the other group.
Perhaps that's true. That's really not my focus of interest.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, between the Jordan and the sea, during the 46 period, you did some special research on that Palestinian group and some of the activities of the Haganah and much of the machinations that took place in advance of their declaration of the state. You want to talk a little bit about some of your discoveries?
Well, that's right, Daryl. The thing that when I talked about history with Palestinians, every Palestinian knew about or referred to at one time or another to a massacre that occurred at Deir Yassin.
Yeah.
And Deir Yassin, it means the monastery of Yassin. The little place where this massacre took place at Deir Yassin is about 3 miles due west of the old city of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
So it was outside of Jerusalem in 1948. But today it is part of Greater Jerusalem because the city has spread out past this little village. However, when I tried to find Deir Yassin on the map, I couldn't find it. And so here was a piece of history that was very important to roughly half the population. And by the way, over half the population between the Mediterranean and the Jordan. That is, over half the population in the borders controlled by Israel today, over half the population isn't Jewish. It is not Jewish, and so to say that there's a Jewish state where over half the people aren't Jews is a mistake,
mm-hmm.
or is an admission that Zionism hasn't worked.
Well, not that they didn't. The Palestinians take an aggressive attempt at large families, much like what they did in Quebec. They said that, you know, we may not have the numbers now, but give us two generations, and we'll build ourselves numbers enough to rise above the the controllers. I mean, we'll elect them out. They have 7, 8, 9 children in many of these Palestinian families. Am I wrong?
You're quite right about the numbers, but. It's not for any type of planned reason. It's Palestine, and Palestinians are really in the third world. They don't have any type of social security system. They have a family structure. They're not as nationalistic as even Americans are. They're family orientated, and so to have a larger family is something that they've been doing for many, many years, but it's certainly not a diabolical plan to outbreed the Jews or something like that.
That demographic was happening, though, isn't it? That demographic is taking place if the Jews were allowed to. I mean, if the Palestinians were allowed to grow, don't they run the risk of being the minority in their own so-called Jewish state?
They already are. Jews are already a minority in the lands controlled by Israel today. They're already in a minority.
So what of all these Democratic declarations of our brainless president, and he's running around the Middle East inflicting democracy on everybody, except where it needs it most? It's amazing to me.
He is being very hypocritical. I mean, the Palestinians voted overwhelmingly for Hamas, which was really a reaction to the United States pushing for the other side.
Yeah.
The Palestinians are a very secular group of people compared to other Arab states in the region. But when the United States and Condoleezza Rice and others like her went to support Fatah, or the party that Arafat had led for so many years, the Palestinians said, you know, Fatah has been corrupt. We want a change. We want something different. And if the United States is going to support the Fatah group, then we're going to vote for Hamas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what they did. And now, these were free and fair elections. Jimmy Carter was there. Other people observed it. No serious commentator has said that the elections weren't free and fair. So now they have a democratically elected government that the United States, that promoted democracy, supposedly, is now refusing to deal with. And the senators and congressmen overwhelmingly voted, or are about to vote, for everybody in the United States to have nothing to do with Hamas. It's a tremendous hypocrisy.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I mean, these kinds of things, Professor, I got to tell you, they don't surprise anybody who's done their homework. But the sad part about this is this history is very well hidden to both Americans and Europeans. Here in France, you get a more balanced view, but still quite skewed in the direction of the Jewish homeland argument, rather than the real problems that take place over there. And I mean, what are we to do to try to take a look at these facts rationally if we can't even get the information?
Well, I think that the internet now provides an opportunity to get the information if people want it, but it's very, very difficult to stand up to Jewish power. And Jewish power comes in a variety of forms. I am not one that believes that it is centrally orchestrated, but there is a tremendous disproportionate power by people. You can call it Jewish power, or you can call it pro-Israel power, or you can call it Zionist power. And it's power exerted not just by Jews, but by Christians and others who insist upon having a Jewish state and land on lands where over half the people are not Jews.
Well, this has turned out to be an ethnic cleansing, a genocidal situation in some instances over there, and it's been perpetrated on the tax dollar of the American public. And the interesting thing is we've got 26 million Christian Zionists in America who have been completely buffaloed into thinking what they're doing is somehow benefiting their belief in God. It is a sick mishmash of sick facts. I mean, these aren't facts. They're fallacy. And our public is being fed these fallacies and continually acting... Jesus, barbaric in my view, and we're doing it again over in Iraq with more ethnic cleansing, with poisoning of DU, and we are the terrorist state of the world, and I am shocked that the American public can't see this.
Hopefully, it's beginning to change.
Well, you would think it would, but I mean, George Bush is still pulling 40% support numbers. I mean, this is astonishing to me. I mean, I can't imagine this man getting 4% support. But see, and then here's the other thing, Dan, that interests me and my listeners here. Everybody wants now to load up this blame onto Cheney and Bush and his regime, when in fact he's merely, he's a puppet to these folks. And we're not able to get past this limited paradigm that Americans have as a view. I mean, it's How do we start wakening people up to the story behind the story? Because they're going to want to put a Democratic group in there next, the Democrat group, and they are as bought and paid for as the Republican group. Mm-hmm. And how do we get them past this ridiculous two-partied paradigm that has been inflicted on the American public for so long, and get them to start really looking at the issues behind this story?
Well, I think that we have to revert to basic American values and get away from the religion and the other things that tend to cloud the issue here. The idea of basic human rights and equal rights of citizenship is something that we as Americans should be proud of and should be willing to fight for in other countries, including Palestine.
That's a wonderful segue, because you have an idea about this, and I'd like you to develop that for the listeners, Dan.
Well, I think, you know, the basic problem there is that you have people that want to make it a Jewish state, and what
yep.
that means is that they want lesser rights or no rights at all for people who aren't Jews. And if you have that kind of a situation, and over half of your population isn't Jews, what do you do with those people? You either can exterminate them, as we did with the American Indians, or you can expel them, as Rehavam Ze'evi wanted to do, the so-called tourism minister in Israel who was assassinated, and many others. By the way, 46% of the Israeli Jewish population is in favor of expelling the Palestinians, taking them out. Now, of course, they don't mean to put them on boxcars and take them out. I mean, the similarity would be just too appalling. But they mean to drive them out, either by physically expelling them, perhaps with buses, or by making life so intolerable for them with checkpoints and daily harassment and killing of targeted killings of
and uprooting of olive trees and destruction of houses and limited water supplies.
Of that type of stuff. They mean to make the life so intolerable for them that they will ultimately leave. But these people can't leave, most of them. Especially the Muslim Palestinians, they can't leave. They have no place to go. And they have these incredible familial ties, incredible ties to families, which makes them stay there. And
mm-hmm.
so they're not leaving. And that has been I think, the root cause of the problem. One of the things that I started some years ago with my friend Paul Eisen from London, is to start a list called RighteousJews.org. And what this is holding a mirror up to the Holocaust industry and the Holocaust approach of righteous Gentiles or honoring righteous Gentiles. Let me explain what that means. In about 1963, the Holocaust industry started this extra program at most Holocaust museums to honor Gentiles, non-Jews, who helped Jews during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they began to make a list of these people and to honor them with a little silver pin and a ceremony.
Yep.
Now, some of these Gentiles could be pedophiles or violent criminals or whatever, but if they saved Jews in World War II, they were conferred with this honor of being a righteous Gentile. And the implication is that those people were righteous, but all the other Gentiles who didn't help Jews during World War II, they were somehow not righteous.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a total misuse of the word righteous, and it was a total ploy to further the idea that Jews were the victims, but yes, there were a few good Gentiles, only a few among them, but there are a few. So what we did, what Paul Eisen and I have done, is to basically hold a mirror up to the Righteous Gentiles program and to say, well, if there are righteous Gentiles, perhaps there are righteous Jews.
Yeah.
And we have defined what it means to be a righteous Jew in a very narrow sense, just like righteous Gentiles is in a narrow sense. And in order to be considered a righteous Jew, you have to, first of all, be Jewish, or consider yourself Jewish. And secondly, you have to believe in equal rights of citizenship for all people between the Jordan and the Mediterranean. Very simple.
Yep.
Very American.
Yep.
Very a universalist human right. Treat me equally. Don't let there be a preferred chosen group to whom only they can own the land, or only they can drive on these roads, or only they can get subsidies to live in settlements for only them. But treat people equally. And if you're a Jew and you believe and you are willing to say that you believe in equal rights of citizenship, then we list you on the list for righteous Jews, which is on the righteousjews.org website, and we give you a little pin. Since we don't have much money, it's a little tin pin. It's not worth very much, but it has.
It's worth everything, Dan.
It has the symbol of the cactus on it, which is in Arabic the sabr, and in Hebrew the sabra, which is basically the same thing. They all know what it is. And it's a unifying symbol. It's a symbol of steadfastness. It's a symbol of toughness and staying the course. It's not a symbol of the Star of David or the Crescent or something that divides people. It's a symbol of something that brings them together.
Much like a pineapple would be for welcoming people in our culture.
It's more important. It's more serious than the pineapple. But
really?
It's a symbol which is accepted by both Israelis and Palestinians and recognized by them as something that pertains to that particular area of the world.
Well, you see, now here's the interesting fact that kind of rises in my thinking here. We've got this situation where 46% of the population there are wanting these Palestinians to be jettisoned from the land. So basically half of their population are guilty of ethnic cleansing, in my view, or wanting ethnic cleansing to take place. How is it that the other 54% can't exert themselves in any meaningful way to stop this activity?
Well, the other, you know, in most instances, you have camp followers. You have people that may not agree with ethnic cleansing, but they are not willing to stand up and be counted against it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was true among the Germans, too. Most Germans didn't want people to go to concentration camps and certainly didn't want them to be killed in concentration camps.
Yeah.
But they went along with it, or they were quiet. A few didn't. Obviously, Dietrich von Bonhoeffer didn't, and Hans von Danani, and a whole group of Germans didn't. But the majority didn't pay any attention to it, and that's what's happening in Israel today. The majority doesn't pay any attention to it. There are Jews in Israel today who stand up for equal rights to citizenship. I think you had one on your show, Israel Shamir, a short time ago.
Yep.
And Uri Avneri and Leah Semmel and Roni Ben Erfrat. And there are many Jews who stand up and do the right thing and practice what Judaism of the prophets said, to treat other people right, to be a light unto nations.
Well, see, now here's the interesting thing, because here's the separation that I've found, this Talmudic tradition where Goyim, which means Amalek, which means anybody outside of the Jewish faith in their view, in this Babylonian Talmudic tradition, is less than an animal in their view. Now, that happens to be the most virulent expression of Judaism, and under those conditions, we will never have these people acquiesce to our hopes that they see the wrong in their actions. Well, if this is their belief, then we're lower than cows, and that's exactly one of the animals that they say we're lower than. Now, this is to me very difficult for me as a non-practicing Jew to I'm not Jewish. I don't want to be considered lower than a cow. And the fact is, this is part of their tradition from this particular group. How do we battle against that?
Well, you're going to have bigots on all sides. And what you've described there is a Jewish bigot. But there are Christians.
Well, no, this is part of their scripture. This is part of their Talmud.
That's true, but that's not true for most Jews. It's true for some Jews who are bigots. And there are bigotry.
But do you see anywhere in the Christian faith where we tell our believers that the people around you, if they don't believe like you, are lower than animals? Or in the Muslim faith? This is the only faith I've ever heard of that actually preaches that within their gospels.
No, Pat Robertson preaches it every Sunday.
But it's not in the Bible documents that's the way it is.
He calls them infidels. His God is better than your God. He refers to Allah as the moon god of Mecca and otherwise puts him down. I mean, you have bigots in all religions. And what you described is bigotry in an extreme form, I think, of Judaism.
Well, this is what the Zionists are actually following. They're following the playbook of the Talmud.
I think they follow it when it's convenient to encourage other people to build a Jewish state. But there are many. It's not part of prophetic Judaism, and it's not part of the type of Jews that we're listing on righteousjews.org. Let me just tell you, Darrell, that this is a very simple project, righteousjews.org. Very simple.
Yep.
But it allows people to stand up and be counted.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows Jews who think that they're the only one in the community who believes in equal rights of citizenship, allows them to express themselves and to see others that are of a like mind.
Yep.
So this project is proactive, it's political, and it's provocative.
Well, I want, in fact, when we're done with this interview, I'm going to have Eric put your link on my site so people can go there, because you know as well as I do, if you take a look at the site, I've tried to bring into my group a lot of people that, I mean, when Israel Shamir put out his take on things, while it wasn't what I had learned, I certainly did not knock him for his new information, and I certainly would like it to be considered in the larger scheme of things, because basically, we're all learning about the workings behind the scenes of these particular groups. This is a process we're taking on here, Dan, and it's a complicated one if you take a look at all the facts. So, I want to make sure that people do see your site, and I want to make sure that people of the Jewish faith who don't believe in these kinds of crazy ideas that are separating us from other people to maybe take a stand on the French Connection or on your site or anywhere that they can.
Sure. Well, let me just tell you why this is a very political listing and approach as well. The list publishes openly and without apology the names of those Jews who oppose the apartheid forced on the Palestinian portion of the population. It published them right out in the open. Hence, it opposes both the policies of the Likud and the Kadima and the Labor government. And it also opposes the Republican administration and the Democratic administration, which unabashedly have supported Israel in all the administrations since Harry Truman. It's a list of people who demand equal rights of citizenship, not some fantasy state with ghettos or bandstands surrounded by a 10-meter-high wall. If you look at a map, and you rarely see a map of what the so-called Palestinian state might look like, Darrell, it looks like Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
There isn't anybody that would say that state is viable.
Yeah.
And it isn't. And hopefully it will never be considered a state because it'll look like a bunch of Swiss cheese.
Right.
In other words, it's political because it says not only do we stand up for equal rights of citizenship, but we are for one state. There is one state called, you can call it Israel, you can call it Palestine, you can call it Isratin, you can call it whatever you want, but there's one state. It has one exterior border, it has one currency, it has one water system, it has one electrical grid, it has people from many different nationalities, including over 1 million Russians, half of whom, by the way, are not Jewish. It has a lot of different people, a lot of different religions, but it is one state, one country. And that's a very political statement because it goes directly against what the evangelicals and the Jewish Zionists want, and that is a Jewish state.
Well, my research tells me that they want more than that. They want an empire to be built in that region. With satellite states that are under their control, including the messianic control of Jordan under King Abdullah. Their control of Saudi Arabia goes back in time, decades, even to the origins. And now we've used our military might to usurp the rights of Iraqis, and it doesn't look like they're stopping there. And so, fact is, when you take a look at neocons, it's a bad name, neocons, because these neocons are by and large Jewish, and they're by and large Zionists. And the fact is, every time you hear neocon, you should be really saying criminal Zionists, is what I see. And the fact is, people don't even get the nomenclature correct.
Well, I would agree with you that I've not yet met a neocon that wasn't a Zionist. But sometimes people use neocon as a proxy for Jewish, and it's not Jewish. It's someone who believes in a Jewish state in Israel, and that is the definition of a political Zionist.
Well, but see, you take a look at this administration in Washington, and I mean, over the two administrations he's led, we've had three rabbis, including one of them from the Lubavitch, Ari Fleischer. We've had Dov Zolkheim. This is beyond the pale is the term that comes to mind when you take a look at the facts behind the American administration. They have taken over our government.
Well, I think one of the ways that this listing, Righteous Jews, is the preferred way of attacking the problem, is that it's very difficult to say this is anti-Semitic or dismiss this as unworthy. We are honoring Jews. We are not. This is not an anti-Semitic. It can't even be called that because it's an honoring of Jews. It honors Jews for the values that are central to prophetic Judaism. Now, it doesn't criticize Elie Wiesel, who is one of the biggest frauds I've ever encountered. It doesn't criticize people like Elie Wiesel or Alan Dershowitz or Abraham Foxman or Morton Klein or Daniel Pipes or a host of other people.
William Crystal,
it doesn't criticize these people who are nothing really but patriotic liars. It simply doesn't include them in the list of righteous Jews.
Oh, well, I'd like to include them in the list of treasonous Jews and have them arrested and jailed. I mean, honestly. I mean, what they've done, if you take a look at it, Dan, is they've sent our young men to fight in a war on behalf of this particular group and murdered over 150,000 Iraqis without provocation, and this, in my view, is a genocide perpetrated by our public, our government, our military. It's unbelievable to take a look at these facts and not place blame where it belongs.
Well, it's much more difficult, Daryl, to get a list together criticizing Jews than it is to get a list together that honors Jews, but ends up at the same point of criticizing Israel as a bigoted, racist state.
Well, you know something? The fight that we're engaged in here is a fight for the hearts and minds of the American public and the Western European public. they are slowly awakening to these facts. You know, there was a time when, I mean, I've got a Pavlov response to the word Jewish. And as many people in America do, when I heard that 8 months ago, when I really started learning about this stuff, I would cringe. You know, if you even said that, because I had been taught that anybody who said that was a potential racist or an anti-Semite, or boy, it's been tough for me to rise above those autonomic responses that have been instilled in me. But rise above it I have, and I've done it by investigating the facts, Dan. And you know what? I think that as the facts become known to more and more Americans, they're going to be angry, because we've been duped. We, by and large, have been duped here.
Well, I think that you know, when Christians are often asked to acknowledge Christian responsibility for the Holocaust. I mean, after all, Hitler was a good Catholic before he was a good Nazi.
Mm.
The Catholic Church turned away from it or didn't stand up enough for it. And even the United States is blamed in part for the Holocaust, because we didn't bomb the rail lines into Auschwitz, or because we didn't accept the Jews on the St. Louis or something else.
Well, do you know all those facts are accurate?
This idea of talking about Christian responsibility and asking Christians to acknowledge the Holocaust, when you're talking the Righteous Jews list, you're talking about an acknowledgement of Jewish responsibility for the persecution and the humiliation and the degradation and the dehumanization of Palestinians, which has been going on now for over 60 years.
Yeah.
And if Christians can be asked for acknowledgement and forgiveness, then Jews should be asked for acknowledgement and asked to be forgiven.
Well, see, you're making an assumption that all the facts around that history of World War II are accurate, and we don't know, because if you try to investigate it, you go to prison.
Well, that's true. There are people today that are in prison. And up for long sentences simply for denying the version of the Holocaust that we were all being taught.
So just to be a history investigator, you can be jailed for 20 years these days.
10 years is, I understand, the max. But
10 years.
I know your point.
Well, that's astonishing, isn't it? I mean, why would you have to hide the facts of something? Why would that be the case? Isn't that one of our basic human rights as well, the right to ask questions?
Well, the United States certainly hasn't supported this in the case of Ernst Zundel.
No.
Zundel was arrested in Tennessee in the middle of the night for a nonviolent supposed crime of not renewing his immigration papers. He was deported to Canada and held, it's unbelievable, in solitary confinement in the Toronto Detention Center for 2 years. He wasn't even given a pencil. He was given little stubs. This is a man who has never been accused of a violent crime. This is a man who is a pacifist. And he gets treated like that, I think it's unbelievable. Or if you look at David Irving, who I really can't stand personally, but here he is in an Austrian court, arrested for a crime he so-called committed 16 years before, when he denied the Holocaust or some version of it in the speech he gave in Leoben. Here's a man who has never committed a violent crime, even by his most ardent detractors have said he's never committed a violent crime. He's sitting in handcuffs in an Austrian courthouse, when Saddam Hussein and Milosevic, they're not sitting in handcuffs in the dock. It's absolutely unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. What are they afraid of coming out, Dan? I mean, why would they be so virulent and aggressive about keeping these people quieted or intimidated? What are they afraid of?
Well, they're afraid of the Holocaust version, the main Holocaust version, which, if you ask the man on the street, 6 million Jews died in World War II, and that was more than anybody else, and they all died in the gas chambers. That's the typical version that's being taught, and of course it's not true. And once you start to look at the facts and figures of it, you, even by Jewish scholars, it isn't true. I mean, there were a lot of people killed, of course. There were concentration camps, of course.
Yeah.
But
terrible suffering from many, many people there and during that period. Awful.
You cannot question the number, or you are so immediately branded as anti-Semitic.
Mm.
You can't you can't question the methodology or the it has to be the gas chamber version, even though most researchers will certainly admit there were no gas chambers. Homicidal gas chambers in the Altreich, or the old part of Germany. But you can't question it. You can't talk about it.
So now that we know that the questions should be raised, yeah.
We have these type of myths in many circles.
Yeah.
I mean, some people can't question the virgin birth, or they can't question Moses parting the sea.
Well, you can question it, but you don't go to prison for it.
Well, a point well taken.
I mean, if I don't think the virgin birth was real, I mean, they don't put me in jail for that.
In other periods of time, of course, the Inquisition, you would have been.
So we've really digressed here. We've gone through human regression in a 60-year period, is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, the similarities are certainly there.
Well, you know something, Dan, you are a wealth, and you've been a wonderful guest here on the French Connection. We have more things to talk about, and I hope you'll return and do another installment some months in the future, or when you have the time. And I'll probably contact you, and maybe you can go forward with some of the same information, because you want to promote the ideas that you're working on, but also maybe another specific area of your investigation, so the people listening to these broadcasts can be brought up to speed on other facts.
I'd be delighted.
It's been wonderful, and I appreciate your efforts, and thank you so much for coming on the French Connection today.
I would just say one thing. If your listeners have any knowledge of Jews who support equal rights to citizenship, if they would get in touch with me, I will submit their names to the committee and hopefully add them to the list.
Well, if they come to the website to do the download, they're going to automatically be treated to your website.
Right, and it's very simple. It's just righteousjews.org.
Fantastic. Well, take a look. You'll hopefully get a nice increase in your numbers for the next few days at least. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now. Ladies and gentlemen, that's Dan McGowan, professor and researcher and lecturer. Talked about a lot of subjects today, interesting things, important things. Many of the subjects we've treated here on the past on the French Connection, but I don't think quite in the same way as Professor McGowan treated them. Of course, he's been savaged by the ADL over the years for being anti-Semitic and every other thing, and I found him to be anything but anti-Semitic. He was genuine and honest, and I think somebody who honestly is working to unite, not divide people. And he really is somebody that we should look to for further information here on the French Connection. I want to thank all of you for tuning in today. This is Daryl Bradford Smith. Until the next installment, be well, and I'll talk to you soon.